Forget about now.
All right, on to the case of Griffin versus the Commonwealth.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
You care to reserve time on this one? Rebuttal time?
Yes, please. Just one minute.
1 minute?
One second, just 1 minute. The issue in this case is whether or not the court abuses discretion in refusing to allow Mr. Griffin to withdraw his plea of guilty. It was an Alford plea of guilty, and first let me state that I think that the standard we need to review it is whether it's abuse of discretion, and the court, I'm referring to the Bottoms case, and I believe this is the best and most succinct statement of the standard here. It says, and I'll read the case. Rather, Bottoms contends that the proper standard requires that the court to determine only whether, based on the facts and circumstances of the particular case, the motion to withdraw a guilty plea is being made in good faith and is premised upon a reasonable basis that the defendant can present substantive and not merely dilatory or formal defenses to the charges. So I believe that it's sort of two prong, good faith and whether he has a defense. I'll deal with that second prong first. He was contending that he had an alibi. And that.
And the case, though, hinges, doesn't it? He maintains that he thought he had a viable alibi defense, was advised otherwise, and then found out, oh my gosh, she will support the story. The court, though, as I recall, had made the finding that it was not good faith because this was information that was available to the defendant previously. Isn't that where we need to focus?
Well, it's interesting because the judge conflates prejudice to the Commonwealth with that argument. Mm-hmm. And I believe he confuses his issues. And I have the deepest respect for Judge Hawks, these things happen on the spur of the moment sometimes. But I believe he confuses that. And I think he was looking at prejudice to the Commonwealth. And that's not in the standard that I submitted. So.
Did Judge Hawks have to accept the defendant's statement that admittedly could be self-serving, that she's now willing to say that I was there without anything from her whatsoever?
No. But if I may, the issue is the mindset of the defendant. Was he doing this in good faith or bad faith? Does he have a good faith to believe that he can submit an alibi defense? And he did everything in support of that. His attorney, Mr. Massey, I believe had some difficulties with his family and didn't receive the missives from Mr. Griffin saying, look, I want to get out of this. And it was almost done right away. And then you have in the record the letter from Mr. Griffin to the court, October 9th, which is not even a month later, saying, look, I want to get out of this. And that. I believe that gives the bona fides to his good faith effort to want to withdraw his Alford plea, and it's important, I think it's an Alford plea, to present his viable defense. And viable is a wrong choice of word. It's a creditable defense. If the trier of fact believes it, he can win. Whether or not the trier of fact is going to believe it doesn't come into this analysis. So. I believe that the judge abused his discretion in this case because he conflated the two, good faith with prejudice. I believe that is what happened here. And if prejudice had never been argued or put forward, and the proper standard had been reviewed, that it is good faith. Because you have also Mr. Massey saying that this is what he was doing. He was doing it right away. And not only that, but I'm the one who misinformed him. So pieces of the puzzle are in place. So it does show good faith. And the idea, I think, when you go all the way back to the Parrish case, the idea is that it almost says, like, for the slightest reason, you ought to let the guy have a trial if he's got a defense and he's acting in good faith. It's almost like, what does it hurt? That would be paraphrasing greatly. But. That's sort of where we are in this particular set of circumstances. Is he says he was ill-advised with regard to the viability of his defense. As soon as he learned it, he tried to turn things around. And because the Commonwealth argued that we were prejudiced. The judge allowed that to enter into what I believe was an improper, or enter into his analysis, which caused him to make the improper analysis and ruling in the particular case. And that's really what I think it comes down to.
Could Mr. Griffin contract away his right to seek withdrawal of a guilty plea?
I don't know.
As he did in this case?
I don't know. I have signed many a plea agreement with my clients like that, but I've never had that issue come up, and I don't know that issue was presented to the court here, and so I didn't argue that. It's not before the court, I looked around for it, but I didn't see any case law on that. But I would say no. As a matter of policy, probably not. What he loses is the benefit of his bargain. We go back to square one, and he's now under the threat of a first-degree murder charge, another charge, other things that we're getting to. So I think that's the penalty for these things. Being a defense attorney, I'm always
except that maybe from Judge Hawk's position, he sees that here's a gentleman that acknowledged within the scope of his plea agreement that he cannot withdraw his guilty plea because it would work prejudice upon the Commonwealth. Now he's immediately trying to get out of it because he knows the Commonwealth has no option if he's allowed to get out of it. Could that be Judge Hawk's analysis?
I don't think so, because this was in January. I believe the hearing was in January. It was several months later. And when he tried to get out of it, it was just a few weeks, maybe even a week afterwards. So
between September 23rd and what the letter or the motion was sent October 9th,
well, he tried to tell his attorney prior.
That was when they got it from the attorney. Tried to do it prior.
Yes, he tried to do it. So, and, you know, that wasn't, no one called that into question. So I believe he tried very quickly to do that. I glean from these facts that he was doing it, as I say, in good faith for his own purposes. Hey, I've got this defense, I want to go forward with it. Not because, I got the Commonwealth, now I can turn it around and walk scot-free. That may happen, but that's not the analysis that's been put in place, my argument is. It's funny, at the end of Hubbard, they mention, this is the next last paragraph before Roman numeral 3, it says, however, as discussed super in the absence of any factual finding of bad faith by Hubbard or prejudice to the Commonwealth, Hubbard's motion to withdraw his guilty plea satisfied the test for Paris. Well, Paris doesn't say anything about prejudice. They didn't cite anything that said prejudice. I don't even know why that's in there, truthfully. I don't think it's part of the analysis. I just think that's a mistake. It's what was argued by the Commonwealth and what the judge, I think, latched onto, and he should.
Counsel, can I ask you a question here? So, backing up, there's a two-prong test for withdrawal of the plea. One is the good faith / prejudice piece, and then the other is that there proffer a reasonable basis for, you know,
not dilatory
not guilty because or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The circuit court ruled on both, but on appeal, it appears that you're only challenging one prong of the test.
Well, the way I read what Judge Hawks ruled, it's page 73 and going to 75, and what I distilled as his argument and thus put in as my error, it's starting at 13. It says, all of these matters were available to the defendant at the time he entered his plea. So number one, I find that there is no real new evidence or mistaken evidence as an underlying basis for today's motion. Well, that doesn't have any new real evidence or anything like that. It's the question is whether the defendant believes it and is acting in good faith, not whether there is in fact, I suppose. Number two, I find that his motion is not made in good faith. He acknowledged in the plea agreement sheet that he understood that the case would be going to trial on the next day, September 17th, unless he took the agreement, and that if he took this agreement, he couldn't withdraw it. It would be a final determination, and that he couldn't withdraw it because it would be prejudicial to the Commonwealth at any later date. Their evidence was based on corroborating witnesses and they were ready to go. So I distilled from that he, there's a lot of stuff in there that I don't think meets the standard by which he should be reviewing it, but he mentioned good faith. He didn't say dilatory, and he didn't say pro forma or formal. So that's why I went in that direction. Because on its face, an alibi defense is a substantive defense.
Right.
And that's where you stop. That's where you stop. Not whether you can present it accurately, but whether you have a defense.
A reasonable basis.
A reasonable basis, yes, ma'am. Yes, and they...
But it doesn't appear to me that on your assignments of error and your argument, you only appear to be focusing on the one prong, not the other prong. That's why I'm asking.
Because That's how I read the judge's ruling. Because I think I'm dealing with an orange when we're looking at apples. I'm all full of those statements today. But if you notice, with regard to the reasonableness of the defense, in the table, well, I think at page 3, you see the notice of alibi that was previously put in. Page 3 of the appendix, there was a notice of alibi put in by the defendant. So it was, I believe, a reasonable and creditable defense that he intended to present, which goes again to his good faith.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Jeffrey.
Good morning, Mr. Court. Thomas Everett from the Attorney General's Office.
I'm curious about two things going into it. If you could address these, please. There's no legal authority that allows for tying a defendant's hand to say that he or she can never withdraw their guilty plea. You see, that's number one. And then number two, do you agree that prejudice to the Commonwealth is not a factor under the Paris case and similars?
It's not a factor that's articulated in Paris. That popped up in Hubbard, and I think this court has addressed it in subsequent cases and said that that is the rule of law. And
that is not.
I know. It's not actually in the Paris case, but that was one of the things. Of course, that case was reversed. Hubbard was, but Judge Humphreys, I think, wrote that opinion. And at the end, basically, the statement was this could be a different situation if the Commonwealth could show prejudice to it. And I don't remember the citation. I mean, I have that stuff in front of me. I can read it if you'd like, but it's in the Hubbard case, and I think it's actually in the footnote, Your Honor. I'm fairly certain that Judge Humphreys, who wrote that opinion, was pretty careful to cite some authority for it. I just don't recall what that was, as I'm standing here.
No,
it's definitely, it's become embedded in our jurisprudence, and I'm pretty certain post-Hubbard that has been discussed in other cases. To answer your first question, I was sort of chuckling myself when Judge Atwood first asked that question. We had all these beautiful research toys, and I was sort of like Mr. Plot. I looked quite a bit for a case that would say something both in Virginia and outside Virginia, and as I was preparing for this argument, it occurred to me that there actually is legal authority for binding the defendant's hands. And the court talks about this provision of the rules in Pritchett. Pritchett was a case that was actually cited to the trial court. I don't think either party cited the court in their briefs in this case. But in Pritchett, if you look at it, they talk about the provision of Rule 3A:8. I'll see where I got the citation. But suffice it to say, and I think the court's probably familiar, there is a provision of Rule 3A:8, I believe I got the rule right, with respect to guilty pleas, and there is, to the best of my recollection, a similar rule in Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 11. And that comes up when a defendant enters a plea where there's not an agreed sentence, but there's an agreement for a recommendation coming from the Commonwealth. And this was something that was discussed quite a bit in the Pritchett opinion, because the court talked about why you could rely on the colloquy. The court might remember that's become a little bit of a hot topic in this area. But one of the things the thing that I think is responsive to the question that both you and Judge Atlee have posed, Chief Judge Huff, is that we've actually got a provision in the state and federal rules where if there is an agreed recommendation only, not a specific sentence agreement, and I will tell you, I mean, at least in my defense practice, I practice in front of judges that just flat basically told their prosecutors they wouldn't take agreed sentences. They didn't like their hands to be tied. It's always a little bit of a white knuckle ride as a defense lawyer. Well, the Commonwealth agreed to 3, but you understand if the court takes you up to 40, you can't do anything about it. That provision of the rule actually ties the defendant's hands. And I would submit to the court To me, by extrapolation, if it's allowed under the state rules, obviously the context is different. If it's allowed under the federal rules, that you can bind the defendant's hands for reasons that is a matter of policy or considered good reasons, that there is nothing constitutionally infirm about that, and in fact, that it is permissible. As far as the context we have in this case, I apologetically, Judge Abbott, you may have found five cases in the interim. I wasn't able to find anything where this specific type of situation had come up. I think that's the best analogy that I can give you, but I would certainly suggest to the court that there is authority to bind the defendant's hands and say you can't withdraw the plea, and there's nothing wrong with that, particularly in the situations that is presented is a good one. This was entered in a knowing and voluntary manner, and I would also suggest to you that Pritchett also, I think, makes it clear that this court can rely both on the things that he did in writing and the things he did orally on the record, where he acknowledged that he understood that he wasn't going to be able to withdraw this. And in fact, I would tell the court, because the court there says all this business about not relying on the colloquy is not applicable to the part of it where this guy's indicating that he understands he can't withdraw this. So I think you very much can look to that in terms of your analysis in this case. Came in, I would indicate to you that at page 20, the court of the joint appendix, the court confirmed that he understood that provision. And obviously there's written things that I had sent up via certiorari as well. And then at the very end, the trial judge essentially, at 27, line 20, the court starts saying, essentially, I'm finding that you're doing this voluntarily, your own free will and volition, nobody's forcing you, tricking you, et cetera, unduly enticing you. The defendant, yes, sir. The court reiterates. Now, I've made that determination. If that's incorrect, you need to tell me now. Is all that true? Yes, sir. And prior to that, he had said that he understood that provision, that he wasn't going to be able to withdraw the plea. So for all those reasons, I do think it's a provision that you can put in the plea agreement. There were good reasons here. It has been suggested that maybe there were more witnesses out there. The fact of the matter is, the Commonwealth, from about 62 to 64, among other things, says this guy's going to get away with murder if the defense is allowed to withdraw his plea. And I would also point out, although that there had been intimation of several witnesses, that one of the witnesses that they were concerned about was the co-defendant to whom they referred as the main witness for the Commonwealth. That's on page 62 of the joint appendix. So I think this suggestion that, well, maybe it would have just been more difficult, I think that's A, it's speculative, and B, it really doesn't matter because the defendant agreed to this. It was knowing and voluntary, and he agreed to this provision. He knew the Commonwealth was prepared to try this the next day. So I think that all factors into your analysis as well. The court talked about bad faith. The court was clearly aware of the standard. With the argument that proceeds, the court's ruling, which starts at about page 72 or 73 of the joint appendix, talks about both bad faith, talks about prejudice, in fact, makes a factual finding that the Commonwealth is going to suffer severe prejudice if he's allowed to withdraw his plea. But I think the defendant is conflating this idea when he says that the trial judge just ruled on prejudice. He clearly understood that there was a bad faith element of this. He clearly understood that this was a defendant who almost immediately tried to renege on an agreement that he had made. And not to beat a dead horse, but obviously there was significant quid pro quo for this. And obviously, as indicated, there was danger on both sides of trying this. I mean, it's pretty apparent to me that there's, probably a decent chance of acquittal in this case, given the nature of the Commonwealth's testimony. But the Commonwealth gave up quite a bit, and admittedly, it gained some certainty, but the same was true of the defendant, so.
Well, an alibi defense certainly is a credible defense, and so, I mean, that's not an issue. It's not a bad faith assertion of the defense that, I have an alibi witness.
Your Honor, I would say, generally speaking, no. I was trying to compare this with Hubbard, where they essentially said, we're not really looking at whether a trier of fact could credit this. I think there's a couple of distinctions with Hubbard. I mean, here the court clearly understood the test and wasn't just focused on knowing and voluntary. That's one key distinction, and post-Hubbard, the court talked about that in Branch. When you've got the court that actually addresses the test, that kind of on its own takes you outside of Hubbard. But I would suggest to you that in terms of the piece of Hubbard that I think you're probably alluding to, where they said, look, because frankly, I'd have to admit that the testimony of Hubbard seemed somewhat preposterous. I didn't intend to kill her, even though I stabbed her 30 times. On his face, that's a little ridiculous. And took the battery out and, you know, told you when you said, call for help, God is on the way, and that sort of thing. I mean, that's not a great defense. But I think one key difference here, and the judge pointed to that, was that this was a self-serving proffer, and it's hearsay. That unlike Hubbard, where Hubbard's up on the stand saying, this is how I would testify if this went to trial and we're trying to put this on, you don't have that here. So I think that concern also about Hubbard is a little misplaced, Your Honor. Misplaced wasn't the term I was looking for. I think it's distinguishable because of that.
Was the trial judge concerned about the fact that the girlfriend wasn't there to say, I would have said this?
Oh, absolutely. He said, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, Your Honor, but...
Well, that's what he said. He said she wasn't here.
He did. We have no idea how she would testify were she here, and in any event, she would be subject to severe impeachment were she here, which, I mean, I guess that next piece of it arguably conflicts with Hubbard, but I think when you combine that in terms of ruling on the motion, the trial judge was entitled to say, essentially, the reasonable defense hasn't been presented either. Now, I will admit candidly from 72 to 75, 76, where the trial judge articulates all these things, he may not say reasonable defense again, but he was clearly aware that was part of the test. He talked about how Ms. Fears, we really don't know what she would say. So I would submit to you that he did rule on it, and it was a concern, it was a legitimate concern, and that piece of it is distinguishable from Hubbard. And I think on appeal, he loses on that prong too.
Does he challenge both prongs on appeal?
I think the assignment, I looked when you asked that question, and the assignment refers to bad faith and prejudice, I think. So I don't think that he says anything about reasonable defense. Now, again, candidly, the court may find something that I didn't. I don't think the judge actually uttered the words reasonable defense when he made his holding, but again, I think if you look at what preceded that in terms of argument and the comment that the judge made, that was both a comment on the reasonableness of the defense and the lack of good faith. But it's not challenged. Is that a fatal defect when he doesn't enunciate clearly that that's where he's going? I think that's a matter that's going to have to, that the court's probably going to have to decide. I think you could certainly decide it as a waiver based on that. I'm not sure that you need to reach that point, Your Honor, because frankly, I think on the merits, this is a strong case, and that may be the best and narrowest way out, which I think one of the courts has recently reminded us sometimes the merits are the easier way out. Reminds me of a doctor telling me sometimes surgery is the conservative option. I think that's true, that's also true with... In this case, I think that the merits, this is a very difficult case, I think, for the defense to overcome the standards. And I think the agreement that he came to, there's nothing, again, unlawful about that or unreasonable about enforcing it under the circumstances. For all of those reasons, I ask you to affirm.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. With regard to the last point, the defense, what the judge doesn't enunciate a ruling pursuant to the standard. He doesn't say this is dilatory, and he doesn't say it's merely form. What he's doing is commenting on the sufficiency of the defense. In other words, well, it's a defense, but it's never going to succeed because she's not here to present the defense. Well, you don't have to present the defense to the judge that's trying to decide whether or not you can withdraw the plea of guilty. You don't have to judge her credibility and whether it's a viable defense on the facts. You have to decide whether, if presented, it is a defense or substance.
What authority do you have for that proposition?
Pardon, Your Honor.
Because it seems to me for the judge to make that kind of ruling, there would have to be some evidence presented to the judge.
Well, I was thinking on the way over here, what is a dilatory defense? I don't know. I'm not sure. I was concerned more about whether, and I, frankly, it eludes me right now where
that's
it's in case law. But they said it's not a matter of whether it's a defense that, you know, won't pass the smile test as far as if it's something that a trier of fact would believe, it would be sufficient for acquittal. In other words, give it to the trier of fact. Don't you, judge, try the case now when you're just trying to decide whether to allow the withdrawal of the guilty plea. That's not what you're looking at. You're not looking at the quality of the alibi defense.
Right, but is it sufficient for the defendant himself to simply say, my girlfriend would have provided an alibi?
If he just, well, you have to look at that in the context of good faith, I would suppose. That's what it goes to, is good faith. Because I think the judge is conflating these things. I think he's putting them together is the problem with this. We don't have a clear thing that we can discern and pull out, and that's the problem. He did not speak in the language of dilatory or formal. His language was, oh, I never believed this defense, sort of. She's going to be subject to cross-examination, and she's not here to present it to me. That's not what you have to do.
Is the judge required to ignore the fact that the Commonwealth previously had a conversation with her and that she would not support the defendant's alibi defense, and then trial counsel had a conversation with her, and while she didn't quite tell him what she told the Commonwealth, it still was not supportive of the alibi defense to the point where he told his client, Mr. Griffin, that it wouldn't work, and then all of a sudden, Griffin then comes in prior to sentencing and says, look, she's going to give me this alibi defense that she wouldn't give according to the Commonwealth and my counsel.
No, he doesn't have to ignore that, but it has to be used as part of his, in my mind, it has to be used as part of his examination of the good faith that Mr. Griffin has exercised.
It is left to the discretion of the court to determine whether or not what Griffin is telling me right now is just he's basically taking what could be a good faith defense and using it in bad faith.
But the judge didn't get to that point. I don't think he got to that point. I think his argument with regard, and the reason I didn't put it in as an error is because when you read it closely, he's talking about the quality of that defense. He's not talking about whether it actually exists or whether the defendant would actually put it forward. In fact, all of the defendant's actions give bona fides to the fact that he intended it to put it forward. He filed his alibi defense. He acted very quickly, as he would have if you talked to this young lady, certainly shortly after the hearing.
Could he have put two and two together? Could he have put two and two together that when he executes that plea agreement, where it says that they're going to be prejudiced to the Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth has said in open court, look, Judge, if you don't accept this plea right now, we have to go to trial because we can't do it later on. It has to be this following day or the next Tuesday or whatever the case may have been, or never. Can the defendant not put two and two together very quickly that right after that, the Commonwealth probably ain't going to be able to put together their evidence again?
Well, I suppose he could. But why not wait until the day? But the argument against that, and that argument, that wasn't fully explored. Why not wait till the day of the sentencing then to do it? Give more time for the case to go sour. You see, I mean, I guess that would be, if that argument was made in lower court. I guess what I'm getting at, and the impression I'm leaving with, is that I believe the judge conflated things in his decision improperly, and that he did not enunciate the ruling. He enunciated a ruling based on a misunderstanding of the law. The prejudice is not a problem of the argument. At least it's not right now. The Hubbard, which is a Supreme Court case, has enunciated the argument, and he conflated prejudice with bad faith, and therefore it was improper, and I would submit that it needs to be overturned.
Thank you very much. As mentioned before, in merit cases, we have the tradition of coming down and greeting counsel. We'll do that, and then we'll begin the writ docket, starting with the case of Curtis Lamont Brown.